Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 12, with Sven Franke and Will Alazawi joining Joran, Louise, and me to consider what failures have taught us about drug development, particularly if the success of the Resdiffra launch. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last September about differences between how we would use NITs to evaluate patients for trials versus evaluate the efficacy of drugs in an individual patient. I begin this conversation by returning to the issue of metabolic drugs, mentioning a recent tirzepatide phase 3 trial that demonstrated efficacy against symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea. This suggests that there is an interplay among many, many different metabolic issues, which Louise Campbell goes on to correlate by pointing out that sleep apnea is also highly correlated with steatotic liver disease, as well as obesity and diabetes. She asks whether this means we need to educate more physician specialties on liver health so that they can appreciate the breadth of its role more completely. Will Alazawi agrees with this suggestion, citing a talk he and a colleague gave at the Diabetes UK conference the previous week that was part of an academic discussion on liver disease. He notes that the session itself was well attended, which surprised him. Will emphasized applauding Diabetes UK for arranging and promoting this kind of multidisciplinary academic session on MASL and MASH. I shift focus by asking what insights investors and other professionals who listen to this podcast might take from the discussion. Joran Schottenberg starts with the most important one. We now know how to get a drug approved. Considering other drugs in development, he adds that the drugs we're studying now may be potent enough to overcome the issues that challenged earlier agents, even the issues we've discussed in this conversation. Sven Franke notes that in future years, the use of incretin double agonists and triple agonists will change the nature of the MASH patient population and make drugs like Resdiffra that have liver-specific modes of action more important and valuable when the incretins don't do the job they might. Having an approved drug changes lots of things for the better, but not everything. This conversation considers some of the issues we've yet to resolve. So just sit back, listen, enjoy, learn. When you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. And one of the points about the earlier trials, certainly the Gilead trials that you made in a different context, but I think is really helpful, is that we were looking to purely intrahepatic modes of action to deliver enough efficacy to make things change, and that hasn't worked. You know, the world is a lot different. A friend of mine who's in dental products, of all things, asked me what I thought the impact would be of the Lilly trial, the Zepbound trial.
Sven Frank.
Tirzepatide.
In sleep apnea, that we're now learning that a combination agent has a significant effect on sleep apnea, something from like 25 interruptions a night down to 5, which is huge. Not surprising. Sleep apnea is closely correlated with obesity. That's a drug that has a lot of effect on obesity. But it does make the point that everything is interconnected in ways that we wouldn't previously have thought, and that the rise in use of GLP-1s and SGLT2s in all settings has several messages to us, some that we've talked about and some about the idea that, to go back to where you were, Sven, that extrahepatic and intrahepatic effects probably are both necessary to generate a sufficient benefit.
Yeah, I think so.
Louise Campbell.
The interesting thing there, if we talk about maximizing a patient's condition, is sleep apnea is also strongly correlated to fatty liver disease. And I wonder what non-invasive assessments they are doing to rule out the hard, enlarged liver underneath. But just as a point, we can rule it into most things where we're looking at cardiometabolic or anything to do with those conditions, but we're not doing it. We're trying to rule everybody else's diseases in or out of hepatology trials and liver trials to make sure that we're trying to deal with the pure, whereas we're not given the same respect in most other conditions. It's very rarely talked about over 5 times the upper limit of normal when the LFTs raise that they're concerned. So maybe we should be arguing for far better awareness of the liver health and the condition underneath, because that's where we're probably going to help diagnose a lot of people that we're missing in other diseases.
William Alazawi.
Louise, I think you're absolutely right. I do think, though, I want to shout out to Diabetes UK, actually, because last week was the Diabetes UK Professionals Conference. So this is essentially one of the big diabetes meetings in the UK. And a colleague of mine, our research manager, Jill Hood, talked about it, and we decided she'd write to Diabetes UK. So she wrote to them and said, why don't we have a session, an academic session, not a sponsored session, on liver disease. And on Friday, Jill and I, which was obviously World Liver Day, Jill and I chaired a session on Friday afternoon at the Diabetes UK conference at Excel, where we have EASL sometimes. And obviously it was a Friday afternoon, and I was expecting, you know, the 4 speakers and Jill and I to be the audience and not anybody else to turn up. And I have to say, the room was full. It was packed. There was some proper debate going on. And much more importantly, it was more full than the arena.
Fantastic. That's really exciting.
Yeah, that's a victory.
Yeah.
His reputation preceded him.
That's a personal win. Will.
I mean, everything's a competition,
it's,
right?
It's a multiple win. It's a win for Will. It's a win for the liver.
right? And you never had any battle with a kidney.
Yeah, and it's a win for Diabetes UK. Actually, I think they were really visionary to go, like, actually, this needs to be part of the academic program, and let's just crack on with it.
What were some of the questions out of interest?
And so, the talks were talks about background of MASH. Helen Jarvis spoke about primary care. We talked about acceptability of pathways and some of the emerging drugs. And the questions were about, you know, the things that we have debated, you know, what's the benefit to the patient? Is there an added burden of excess testing? What do we do when we've found these patients? But to have that debate properly and to have it done in a sort of a proper session, I thought was superb because we were able to expand some of those arguments. And it's only through that conversation, of course, the conversation went on after the session as well. So I think we just need to get ourselves at these meetings. It's a bit of a seg. I mean, I wanted to plug Diabetes UK. To your point, yes, we do need to talk to people in other disease areas.
But that's encouraging stuff.
Yeah, I like to present it as vicious circles because it's multidirectional and everything is pushing everything. So it's not just one pushing the other. It's really turning around. And what we need to do in our management is just stop those vicious circles to turn or make them turn the other way.
I'm picturing a Rube Goldberg machine being thrown into reverse and watching all the different disparate pieces try to rejigger themselves to go in the opposite direction, right? It isn't a simple task to make everything go in reverse. All right. So what does this tell us going? What does any of this tell us going forward? We have an audience of people who are in investment or in other ways, shapes, or form interested in predicting the future. And knowing what we've learned about what doesn't work should be one of the helpful elements in telling us what does work. So,
Jörn Schottenberg.
Yeah, Roger, let's revisit your first question. Is there ever going to be a drug approved after all these failures? And there are two great articles we discussed today, one by Sven and colleagues and one that we put up in the earlier days. And I think that the signal is very clear. Even after that article, there's a drug approved and we have learned a lot as a field and we are in the position to get more drugs over the finish line. And we'll be, in the end, mixing and matching those drugs. And I'm very convinced that with all that learning curve, and despite all heterogeneity and some inaccuracy in endpoints, maybe, the potency of the drugs we're looking at today is clearly set to overcome those hurdles and get through the finish line.
So I think that's an excellent starting point, right? Which is going back to Sven's point number five, maybe the drugs don't work that well, or some of the drugs that were being evaluated at that point in time didn't work that well. We have drugs right now that appear to work a lot better. Now, that still doesn't mean that we don't lose all the aldafermin because of one funky cell somewhere in the middle of the design. But yes, clearly we're seeing more promising results with a more promising set of agents. I'll tell you one specific question I've got, which is if the intrahepatic effects are not robust enough to drive a drug to approval, but are real, will there be a point at which we can marry up intrahepatic and extrahepatic effects in combination agents? And do we have the tools to make that work right now?
What might happen, I think, is that with all the drugs coming in terms of the GLP-1 dual triple agonists will already drastically change the background therapy of our patients. And probably there is, for some, there might be some direct intrahepatic effects. There are anyhow very strong extrahepatic effects that take away a lot of driving force of the disease, not always completely, but a lot of driving force of the disease. So a substantial proportion of patients will improve their liver health along with their cardiometabolic health. So it will probably shift a little bit the strict indication for a pure anti-MASH liver-targeted therapy, which I think is good, but we should consider that the background therapy of those patients is rapidly evolving, and that changes also our field. And I can imagine that in those patients with that kind of background therapy, still having clinically relevant liver disease, a more liver-targeted treatment will be even more important than probably it was before, because you have a lot of possibilities now to improve the cardiometabolic milieu. But still, all with resmetirom, it's different because there we have really a liver-targeted therapy with, besides the LDL improvement, it has not so much effect on the cardiometabolic milieu. So it's really an intrahepatic anti-MASH treatment. And I think that might get probably even a stronger indication if the metabolic background therapy is optimized.
Roger, can I just get, I have to say, I agree with what Sven said. The premise of your question actually is really interesting. That's sort of got me pondering. That lack of efficacy in the liver, if I understand you correctly, would therefore be a reason to partner with a drug that had efficacy outside the liver, as some kind of a fig leaf to cover the reduced efficacy that we're seeing. And I think that as a rationale for combination probably is not a particularly strong rationale. I think the concept of combination for its own sake, is very firmly established in infectious diseases, where there is selective pressure, or in cancers, where again, there you're applying a selective pressure to something that has a very rapid evolutionary risk of becoming resistant. That, I think, is very cogent. Or you are combining two things where really you want a drug that's got a dual effect. The drug has a dual effect, combined agonists at different receptors in a similar pathway. But I think what we're describing is an a priori, either add-on or type of scaled approach to treatment of MASH in the same way that we might have two, three, four agents for one's hypertension. But I think that needs to come because each medicine stands on its own feet, not because one medicine can be brought in to cover up for the other. Unless, I guess, what you're saying is you're going to take through a combination as the drug itself. But then I would want to look at that a bit more carefully and ask, why is it that each individual drug isn't alone? And then you're post-marketing trying to combine the two. And I think that, my only personal view, is that as more drugs get to license on their own merits, people will be asking those questions further down the line. If it were the case that no one drug can get over the line, then I think maybe we will end up in that situation. But that's my view on the combination, which is it doesn't need to be the case that it's going to be a combination. We might get there, but the reasons and the routes why we get there, I suspect, aren't quite clear just yet.
So, Will, I think you touched at the end on kind of what I was trying to ask, not very articulately at the beginning, which is that it's easy to foresee a world in which two monotherapies become approved as a combination agent. What happens less frequently, but from time to time, infectious disease being, I think, a good example of that, is that you see therapies approved with multiple agents and then where at least one of them might not stand on its own, but has an augmenting effect on the others. And thinking of how many modes of action are involved in liver disease, in steatotic liver disease, I kind of wonder whether that might turn out to be a case.
Sort of a metabolic equivalent of ritonavir boosting type thing.
Check. That's exactly where I was going.
Ribavirin story.
There you go.
Yep. Might be. But
yeah. It might be. I mean, the other thing, of course, we could talk about is intra versus extrahepatic effect. I mean, increasingly, if you sort of work in the metabolic space, then, you know, we're seeing even our own labs, Sven and I have talked about this before, you look at what's happening at other sites, and actually that has a direct impact on what's happening in the liver. You know, work from our lab is showing that cells can circulate, probably the same cells that you see in inflamed adipose tissue or also in inflamed liver tissue. So I think you've got, you know, the idea that something might work in the liver or in the adipose or elsewhere, I think may be moot because it may well be that the same agents, the same things that are causing the injury are circulating around.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. Next week, we will preview Global Fatty Liver Day from the Global Liver Institute, which will fall on June 13th. We'll have several patient advocates and at least one physician champion with us. Until then, stay safe, surf on, say a prayer for our departed colleague, Stephen, and his family, and we'll see you next week on the podcast. Bye-bye now.